Chinook. It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
In Yupik Eskimo, Nunam Klutsi means protectors of the land, and it is the name for a Bethel-based organization directed by scientist and former area science teacher Harold Spark.
The function is to keep the villages advised on regulatory and development changes which are occurring in western Alaska, which are going to influence the village's way of life and, frankly, their survival into the 21st century. We were created in 1973 when the unorganized borough government of this region, the Association of Village Council Presidents, determined that they, as individual villages, were not able to keep up with most of the changes that were occurring in the resource issues, both renewable and non-renewable, and that they were being overwhelmed. And I think the best way of describing Nunam Klutsi is how one of our board members referred to us. He said, well, when we got started in 1973, we were able to tell the villages about 6 months after someone had changed their life what had happened. Now we're gotten so good that we give the villages 3 minutes' notice that a change is going to happen. And frankly, that's what we do. We concentrate in information on public policy issues, and we do it in Yupik Eskimo. We use KYUK in Bethel, KNOM-KICY in Nome, and KDLG in Dillingham in order to spread the message that something that the villages are interested in is happening, and that if they don't participate, they're going to lose because they will not be included in the decision-making process. In regard to renewable resources, we work on fisheries issues, not only the inshore allocation of the whatever fish survive and get inshore, but also the high seas interceptions of those fish, which is causes tremendous management problems and allocation problems. In western Alaska, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, migratory birds, the fur trapping, and how to generate a more adequate knowledge of the importance of fur trapping to the village economies and improving the quality of those. And additionally, we work on the quality issue on salmon also and herring in order to upgrade the prices that people receive as ex-vessel values. Anything that has to do with what the people eat, what feeds their ecosystem, we work on. And we have spent particular time on subsistence. Now with Reagan cutbacks and with the reapportionment, you're going to lose one senator and one representative in western Alaska. We can certainly see a time when state cutbacks can occur. And the villages have been very flush in the 70s, and that flushness has made former luxuries necessities now, and something's got to give. And what should not give is the people's ability to feed themselves. We feel that with the cash cutback occurring, and right now recent studies have proven that about $8 out of every $10 it comes here as government. It's federal and state government. They have 20 cents on every dollar is locally produced. It's a very untidy welfare system, which is really significantly being threatened by Reagan and by just the loss of political influence in the state legislature, which is a natural consequence of reapportionment.
Isn't there a special relationship, however, between the federal government and Alaska Natives that should not be changed and violated as provided for under the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, for example?
Well, that's fine in theory. In practice, I believe that if you look at the recent newspaper articles about the Bethel Public Health Service Hospital, you'll see where Reagan's supposed safety net obviously missed this region. You're going to have significant problems with villagers getting in here to get adequate medical care. In regard to this trust responsibility, the North Slope Borough joined the governor and the Natural Resources Defense Council in suing the five-year leasing schedule. And the way that the secretary, whichever secretary of the interior you're talking about, developed their Outer Continental Shelf leasing schedule, and the court specifically found that the secretary did not have a trust responsibility to the native peoples of the Arctic Slope to protect their interest in regard to offshore exploration in endangered whale, bowhead whale critical habitat. I think that you'll find more and more a deferral to the wealthy coffers of the state of Alaska by the federal government, be it a Republican or being a Democrat. I mean, Senator Stevens is, and Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young have well warned us that this was coming, and it's going to hit rural Alaska harder than urban Alaska.
How do you anticipate that federal cutbacks will affect the enactment, the enforcement of the subsistence protection provisions of the ANILCA legislation?
Well, we have been talking with the secretary when he was with BOR back in 1975, so he was well aware of the subsistence issue, even though he did not have an interest at that time in the Department of the Interior. So he personally was aware of it. And his chief aides, many of whom were involved with the ANILCA legislation, are now working for him in the department. They're very much aware of it, too. When a reporter asked the secretary, well, what's going to happen if the state revokes its, either through legislative action or through the referendum, revokes the Legislative Act 151, the state subsistence preference law? And the secretary is very clear. He says, well, I don't expect the state to do that. In the event that they do it, then by statute, I have to step in. Now, you'll have people who will interpret that as saying, well, Watt makes policy by just defunding things. So he can say one thing, and then he can defund it, and then you have an actual vacuum being created. In this case, you have a statute, which is very important. The statute says that we're not going to make the mistakes that we did in 1958 under statehood and under ANSCA, where we said, Secretary of the Interior, we want you to make sure that the state's going to be a good guy to all these people living out in western and rural Alaska over subsistence allocations. This time Congress went so far as to describe how the secretary has to keep attuned to the subsistence issue, and they dedicated an entire session to it. To Title 8 of ANILCA, and they also dedicated special language in the titles on wild and scenic rivers, on the creation of national refuges and parks, declaring that subsistence was a purpose for establishing these federal conservation units. The secretary is going to be under a lot more pressure on our side with the a potential cutback, an already existing cutback, but even more deleterious cutbacks in the future. The people are going to need subsistence even more than they've needed in the past when you've had all this free money rolling around in the villages. They're going to have to economize their harvest. They're going to have to go after species which are going to produce volume protein for the amount of money that they have. You're going to see a greater concern for enforcement to make sure nothing is wasted. And it's going to be tough. The people have been tough before. They got a little sloppy with all, again, the free money running around. But they have it within their nature, within the society, to, you know, pull in their belts and recognize the realities and live with it. They have to convince Secretary Watt that he has to live with it, too.
Could you give a brief profile of the subsistence use of people in this region?
Principally, it's dependent upon the resource at hand. The villages are in areas which we call staging areas, convenient places to hunt and fish from. In many cases, the BIA dictated where the villages were going to be because by the location of schools. But generally, those are still within resource-populated areas and adjacent to areas where seasonal migrations occur. It's relatively economic to harvest out of those areas in both time and money. You just have to make sure you're there when the salmon go past or when the marine mammals migrate in the spring or in the fall in order to catch them. That takes skill and fortitude, but it also takes some dollars to do that. you have to get out there with a snow machine or with an outboard. The people generally depend upon fish here. The surveys that the villagers helped us do in 1974 and 76 revealed about 16.5 million pounds of food harvested off of the land. 72% of that, or about 12 million pounds, was fish, salmon making up about 3 out of every 10 pounds for fish. But there was also great use of domestic fish, the freshwater fish, like sheafish, whitefish, pike, and then the saltwater or marine fish. We have certain forms of whitefish which are caught in the ocean, and herring, tomcods dominated the coastal communities' harvest. So you have fish is the major ingredient. On the coastline, as much as 12% of the village's food intake is marine mammals. It goes down to about 3 or 4% when you get onto the Yukon or Kuskokwim rivers. It's not as significant because they can get their red meat from moose or from land mammals, which the coastal villages do not have available to them. Birds make up about 4% of the biomass that's harvested. And plants are about 1 to 2%. That's mostly berries, but there are some edible green plants that people harvest here. And again, it comes up to about 16.5 million pounds of food. The closest, you asked a question earlier about subsistence and Secretary Watt and how things are. It'd be difficult to estimate what that was going to cost because in addition to having to transport in, what did the government give Nuwatuk and the villages up in the Kobuk? I think they gave them peanut butter and eggs to replace the caribou in 76. You would have to build an infrastructure to bring in imported foods. That does not exist in the villages either. So it's rather foolish to say, well, let's see, if you caught 16 million pounds of edible protein, that's wet weight, not the dried weight, let's say $2 a pound, so it'd be $32 million. Well, that does not include the airport developments, the road developments, the entire transportation network that would be required with all the attendant costs to be put into import 16 million pounds of food. And that's always the hidden integer. And I think the government, both federal and state, learned that in the crash of the Northwest Arctic caribou herd in 76, what it cost to replace local protein. And you saw a great sympathy by the federal government and I'd say, at best, a neutral sympathy by the state of Alaska to make sure that the local people harvested local resources to feed themselves. The federal government was convinced by that 76 crash of what dangers were inherent if suddenly you had to start importing food into rural Alaskan villages.
Aside from federal cutbacks, do you feel that ANCSA and subsequent amendments, including ANILCA, provides adequate protection for continuation of subsistence use?
As long as the villages are cognizant of what they are facing. If the villagers let other people do it for them, they're in trouble. You can have as many laws as you want, but if you do not have an informed populace that understands where its bread is buttered and where that butter comes from, the butter being the surplus renewable resources, they are going to be in trouble. I think that you're going to see much more interest by the villages to protect what they have. And they're coming of age politically. They're learning what is important to them and what is surplus or luxuries. And that choosing, the difficulty is that the choosing occurs now on a regional level. There's been very little effort on the statewide level of native leadership getting together and understanding what the village's priorities are and then making cuts. That's going to have to come with age. That'll come as a political process develops. The language is there. We worked on that language beginning in 1973. We wrote our own bill in 73, as a matter of fact, most of which was incorporated in the final language of Title 8 in ANILCA, and we're satisfied with what is there. Using it, of course, is the biggest problem.
ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, and ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980, two complex documents with considerable impact on village survival and the continuation of a subsistence lifestyle still tenable in the villages of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. You've heard Harold Spark, executive director for that region's Nunam Klutsi, Protectors of the Land. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. This program is one in a series presenting the Wolf Dance performed by the King Island Dancers on February 23, 1982 in Nome, Alaska. On that evening, the National Guard Armory in Nome was packed. People sat, stood, and leaned anywhere they could, waiting for the first performance of the Wolf Dance in nearly 50 years. There were people from Barrow, Wales, Suvunga, Shishmaref, Stebbins, Kotzebue, Gamble, Diomede, and other villages, plus a few from Anchorage and Fairbanks and even Washington, D.C. And it seemed like nearly everyone in town, all 2,000 or so, was packed into the armory as well. It is said that the dance the King Islanders performed originated in Kuwirok and was last seen in the early 1930s when aviator Charles A. Lindbergh visited Nome. In the past, the dance went on for 3 days, but the February 1982 event, part of the Bering Straits Elders Conference, took less than an hour. There were other differences as well. For a 1914 wolf dance in the village of Mary's Igloo, a special Kazgi ceremonial house was built. This one was danced in the high-ceilinged armory. For the 1914 event, it took a long time to get ready, both for the hosts and the visitors. Eskimos came from hundreds of miles away, traveling by dog team and on snowshoes. In 1982, most people came by airplane, with an occasional snow machine ride or trip by car over the road from Teller. And in the past, there was no need for outside funding to put on the traditional event, not that there was any. But for this wolf dance, there were grants from the Alaska State Council on the Arts, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the King Island Native Association, funds for performers' fees, transportation, and supplies. The organizer for the dance, the prime mover, was Paul Tiolana. He's a well-known craftsperson and dancer from King Island, now living in Anchorage.
There's only three elders that really know how to do it. And if I do it in 5 years, I wouldn't have resource people that really know how to put it in, put the wolf dance together. I should have done it 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but I don't find no funding. Well, there's quite a few elders still living at King Island that really know how to do it. We all knew, we never seen this before, how it is done. And these men never saw it before. Also, the women never saw it before. Their motions, their parts, we never seen it before. So they work so hard. All of us work real hard. As myself, as my part, I was chosen to be the drummer. And I have no idea how I'm going to motion my body to give instruction for the dancers. The whole thing is based on the drummer, the way he moved his head so the dancers could move their hands and their arms and their head as the motions of the drummer. He gives signal, next step, what's going to be.
What kind of drum is it?
It's the box-like drum. It's over there. We made it ourselves also.
It's a wooden drum?
Right.
It's wooden?
Yeah, it's wooden drum. And we was going to use the old one, but it cracked got cracks in there. It doesn't have the sound just the way we wanted. So we make the new one within a week. So everything is so, you know, try to get all the material put together. It's so, our time is kind of short.
Tijuana is 60. His assistants were all over 70. They instructed the dancers and singers in their roles and in the costuming, stage set, and making drums. Sometimes it took all of the elders to remember a particular part of the wolf dance.
Frank, he's the one that physically stand up and give us the motion part, but the other couldn't stand because he got real weak legs. And he gives only his arm motion, which is not enough for dancers to follow, but because you have to move your knees and your arms accordingly.
What is the wolf dance like? How many dancers are there, and what do they do?
There's four heads, four handlers, and five women and one drummer. And rest of it will be the singers. Also, the singers are also the main part, because we have to sing different song for different part.
Okay, you mentioned handlers. Then are there some people who are
assisting? They have to watch when the men coming out with the welfare through those holes, and they have to watch every second their heads and their body, which is. They say it's helper for the dancer coming out with a warhead. So everything is really confusing. What next part going to be? It's mostly to me because I only have one instructions. Then I told Frank to repeat it so I could try to follow his motions. How he done it during the songs.
Where Frank Ilana helped with the motions to the songs, others assisted with other aspects of putting on the dance.
Joachim Kluk and the Clara Sokolov and Ursula Ilana. They really didn't, the rest of it didn't really come out to give us some instructions, but they give us a hand on the remembering the songs. And we have to practice about half an hour to an hour try the song.
How long have you been working on this performance?
How long? I come here January the 11th, and I started out the next day after I arrived. I work with the elders first. Talk with them and see what kind of help they are going to give us, because there are something else attached to the wolf dance, which is the which I really want, are the roots of our culture, what our roots are, what kind of responsibility that each person have towards for betterment of their village.
For Tijuana and his colleagues, this was the time to nurture those roots.
There's quite a few have been telling me and encouraged me to do it, because it has to be done. Otherwise, we're going to lose it. We are going to lose our respect. We're going to lose our identity if we don't teach it again. So I feel strongly in my heart, in my soul, to do it.
The elders that collaborated on teaching the dance selected four King Island men in their 30s to be the principal dancers, and other men and women as their helpers during the dance. Beginning in January, the elders worked with the younger performers. I spoke with one of the young men on the morning of the performance. We were in the King Island Community Hall in Nome, standing in front of the set. A 16-foot-long plywood box, 4 feet tall and the same distance across. There were four small circular portholes evenly spaced across the front of the box.
My name is Francis Alvana from King Island.
And what's your part in the Wolf Dance?
There'd be four dancers here, and I'm one of them. In front of this thing here.
Do you crawl through those holes?
My hole is second, left right here.
You're going to crawl through that?
I am. I jump in here.
What'll you be wearing when you do that?
That headpiece I was wearing when you guys first came in, and those long mittens.
What are those mittens made out of?
Sealskin.
The mitts reached right up under his armpits and were covered with puffin beak rattlers.
Francis, how did you get involved in this, in being one of the...
I live with him.
Have you danced in other dances before?
Ever since I remember.
Francis Alvana said he guessed he was excited about the evening's performance, but not especially nervous about it.
How do you feel about tonight?
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll make it.
I've seen it a long, long ago. Long time ago.
Margaret Sigana, a King Islander now living in Nome, is one of the few people who remember seeing the Wolf Dance.
They had what I saw of it was I wouldn't remember too well. But they had the same kind of setup as they have here. And there were the men I saw do it were not all King Islanders. They had people come from Wales, and I think there were a couple of Wales men from Cape Prince of Wales. I think there were two from there and two from King Island that did it.
Where did you see it?
It was here in Nome, and during those years, there was a BIA school for natives only. And it was done here in Nome, in that school. There were many, many, many people here, people from Wales, from local natives that had come to Nome and lived here. And the King Islanders were here from the spring coming over, and they'd stay 3 to 4 months here in Nome and then go back to King Island for the winter. And before the King Islanders did go back, they had the Wolf Dance. I don't remember the year, but it was in the 30s that I saw it.
You were a young girl then.
Mm-hmm. I was young then. I was right into the spirit of it. I was right there with them. It's what would you call it? Unity. You see, there were people from different villages, but it was just done perfectly in unity. And I think what the Wolf Dance did to villagers, when one village was giving a Wolf Dance, they'd send out messengers to other villages. And these villages would come together to have the Wolf Dance. And I think what I felt was the unity within that group and the spirit of it. It isn't all just what you see. You feel it. There's vibration in it. And what that vibration does brings unity. And it's hard to explain.
Is there some of that same feeling now for this Wolf Dance?
Yes, for the practices I've seen, I've, I felt it.
In the next Chinook, we'll hear and experience the wolf dance through the vibrations of radio. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans. Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. This program is one in a series presenting the wolf dance performed by the King Island Dancers on February 23, 1982, in Nome, Alaska. That was the first of two performances during the Bering Straits Elders Conference. As far as anyone could remember, they were the first performances of the wolf dance in 50 years. In the past, the dance took 3 days, but in 1982, the wolf dance performed in the Nome National Guard Armory was less than an hour. Reconstructing the dance after a half-century lapse was difficult. Several elders collaborated on remembering the motions and songs, working with organizer Paul Tiolana and the men and women dancers and helpers. Margaret Sigana, a King Islander now living in Nome, saw the wolf dance when she was a young girl. While not directly participating in this performance, she was eager to see it again and visited the King Island Community Hall in Nome on the morning of the 23rd, watching the preparations for that evening. I asked her why she thought so many years had passed since the last wolf dance.
Many villages had been banned from doing the Eskimo dances. And I think that's what caused that gap. Many villages gave up the Eskimo dancing altogether. From other villages that I've heard, missionaries were telling those village people that it was bad, that they were working for the devil. So with King Island, our missionary told the people, give up what's superstitious or whatever in those dances and give the rest up to God as a thanksgiving for whatever he gives. And that's what they'd been doing all the years I was on King Island with them, from 1934 to 1959. They'd have the entertainment dancing when they went back to King Island every evening. But there were certain times during the Advent before Christmas, 4 weeks before Christmas, they didn't do any of those dances. And then they picked them up right after Christmas and then went on until before Easter, the 6 weeks they have there. The Lent season. They don't do it through there. And when they, after Easter, they pick up maybe for a month or so. And it was all entertainment, more entertainment than anything else. Because when we went back to the island, there was nothing to do. They didn't have the stores or the theaters they'd been going to when they were here in Nome. And so to fill the gap of the long evenings, dark evenings, they'd have the dances. And that brought the community together. And there was this feeling of unity. And They had more understanding.
The feeling of unity Margaret Sigana felt from the dances of her childhood seemed renewed for the Wolf Dance of 1982. Sharing the King Island Hall were visitors from the villages of Diomede and Wales, and there were people from perhaps a dozen villages and cities waiting in Nome for the evening's performance, much as it was for the dance Sigana saw in the 1930s.
Maybe the word got out that they were going to do this. And there were a lot of natives. It was in that, we talk about that old school that the BIA had for only natives. And it was, they had it there.
Before there was that BIA school, where would people hold a dance like that?
They, in their villages, in their own villages. They had kakjik to do it in.
That's a ceremonial house.
But for the mainland people, they had messengers. They send out messengers to go tell the people that they were having the wolf dance at a certain time, certain place, certain village.
The dance they came to see was formerly called the Eagle Wolf Dance or Eagle Wolf Messenger Feast. Paul Tiolana tells the story of the dance.
You see a hunter kill a big giant eagle one time. And he preserved the skin nice and dry. Whenever the weather's good, they put him up so the mole wouldn't get inside. And the years later, there's another eagle appeared to him, and that man ready to shoot him. But he took his hood off and said, "Don't shoot, I'm gonna take you to my mother." And the mother gave all the instructions for that person when he go back to his village. You're gonna see the part of it tonight. And if we make a few mistakes, that won't be problem, because it's really confusing. Really confusing dance. So we probably make a few mistakes. Getting us ready for this dance, everybody cooperate. And everybody, I think, is believing it. That's why they never hesitate to help. And that makes much easier for us to try to prepare all the material that we need. Even though we have it's not complete, but even a little part of it, if it's preserved, I'll be satisfied. Real satisfied. Because I've been working on it for 20 years, try to find some funding for it. And finally, it's gonna be done tonight. So I'm happy, real happy about it.
The performance was scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. By a little after 6, the National Guard Armory was packed. There were snoozing infants, lively youngsters of all ages, adults and elders. A number of women had tattoos on their faces, lines on their chins, cheeks, and foreheads framed by pulled back white hair and wolverine parka ruffs. On the stage in front of the room was an unpainted plywood box, 16 feet by 4 by 4, with four circular cutouts on the front. Portholes into the wolf's den where the four main dancers would suddenly disappear with a dramatic backwards push-up and later reappear wearing full masks made of wolf skins. A polar bear skin hung on the wall behind the box.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Through the good spirit of the Inupiat, we want to show our appreciation for your attendance of this elders conference, along with our special wolf dance as passed on to us by our ancestors. Help us in your prayers so that Inupiat culture may endure in the generations yet to come. The King Island people, signed Gabriel Mactoya, President, King Island IRA Council. Kuyana. Thank you. over to the Wolf Dance, we will give you a few tokens as gifts.
In the past, when a Wolf Dance was announced, there was great anticipation of the gift-giving. Cross cousins could ask each other for anything they wanted, and in the interest of friendship, it was expected the request would be fulfilled. Rather than the traditional exchanges, Paul Tijolana, who would be beating the special drum representing the eagle's heartbeat later in the evening, was joined by several others who would be part of the dance in distributing oranges, apples, lollipops, and butane lighters with the name of a grocery store on one side and the King Island Native Corporation on the other, giving not just to cross or teasing cousins, but to nearly everyone in the crowd of at least 2,000 spectators. The men singers, drummers, dancers, and helpers all wore light blue T-shirts and pants, mukluks, and had either beaded or black and white fur panels on their chests. During a live broadcast of the Wolf Dance over radio station KNOM in Nome, Margaret C. Gana describes the costumes.
These are replicas of weasel hides. They used to use a lot of weasel hides in this dance. And the women have kind of fans in their hands, which they are going to use for dancing.
The fans were eagle feathers. Just before the dance was to start, after the boxes of gifts were passed out, the men donned either eagle or fur headdresses, and some added arm-long sealskin dance mittens, dyed red with alder bark and with an opening for bending at the elbow. They were covered with rattlers of ivory and puffin beaks. At first, four men in light blue shirts and pants and five women wearing fur parkas danced to the traditional circular Eskimo drums. The drumsticks were made of strips of axe handles fashioned earlier that day. Four more men joined the others on stage. The five women and four of the men got on top of the plywood set. The men positioned themselves over the portholes, now covered with square steel-gut flaps, like windows used in old times for semi-subterranean sod houses. Margaret Sigana and KNOM announcer Brother Norman describe the scene.
The people above on the platform up there, they call those the... you call them. They're taking care of the needs of the dancers. And if any of the dancers, they have to pull up these seal skins and let the opening show so the dancers can get inside later on.
I see. At this time, we have nine dancers sitting up on top of this raised portion. We have four more men sitting down on the stage with their back toward the people and facing each of the four seal skins. And right in the middle is a long pendant, I guess, with something hanging from it.
That's the drum. The wooden drum they use for the wolf dance. They don't use the regular drums that they use for dancing. They use the wooden drum. It's a square drum. It's about maybe 3 feet high, and it's hollow inside. Now the men have put on their headgear, the eagle feathers in the long mittens, and they are getting ready for the beginning of the wolf dance.
In the next Chinook, we'll hear more of the eagle's heartbeat in the drum of the wolf dance. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.